are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, October 24th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, distinguished professor of history of black studies at the University of Missouri, Devin Fergus, on his book, The Land of the Fee, Hidden Costs and the Decline of the American Middle Class. Also on the program today, one day after a bomb was found in George Soros's mailbox, bombs found in mail to both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, and a pipe bomb just found at CNN. Meanwhile, the lies about the caravan almost drowned out by the lies that there's a new middle class tax cut. Meanwhile, Georgia Secretary of State Brian Kemp fears the exercise of people's right to vote. And it turns out he has a slight problem with a loan he made to himself from his bank that he owned. Didn't pay back.
It's a good deal.
It's a good deal.
Nice.
Good original concept there.
And nice living well if executed. you can score it. Meanwhile, early voting in Texas setting records, but will it matter? And the Trump administration politicizing administrative judges on the board of veteran appeals. And white supremacist Richard Spencer turns out to be just as abusive to his own family as to anybody else. And the White House issues a comedically inept anti-socialism screed. And grift update, walk away, walks away from walk away. And the Creation Museum possibly headed to extinction. All this and more on today's Majority Report, ladies and gentlemen. We will get to that Creationism Museum story, because longtime listeners will know that this has been one of my bailiwicks for a decade. In fact, you know what? Maybe we should even hold off on it until we dig up. I did a couple of phone calls to the Creation Museum. I think the Answers in Genesis people, I think before it was even built. And back in the day when I used to make, I wouldn't call them prank phone calls, because I would very quickly at the beginning of the call say that this was being recorded for air. And I would introduce myself as a reporter from the Majority Report. Sometimes it was the family reporter. Sometimes it was the chastity reporter. That gets you... Back in the day, if you said you were from the Majority Report and you were the chastity reporter, there was basically nothing you couldn't get a fundamentalist Christian to tell you, even if they thought it was going on air. I had one guy tell me that he thought a little bit of bullying of a kid who might be a little bit gay in school was okay. But maybe we'll dig those.
I bet that really upset you, Samantha.
We'll dig those up. But when I launched this show, this iteration, I think maybe this is even before you were here, Michael, I would read a listener had sent me, or I can't remember who it was. Maybe it was Kyle. Got me a book of the Creation Museum. And you know, once a week I would read a little segment of it so that people could find out where stuff really came from instead of all that mumbo jumbo about coming from the water or whatever it was. So the idea that the Creation Museum may be in some way faltering, it's sort of fascinating. Because you would think, like, all that God stuff would be timeless. But apparently it gets a little boring after about 2 or 3 years.
It's a lot of competition, too.
Yeah. But we will get to that. And, of course, we had that report yesterday that the Hobby Lobby family, they got ripped off and bought 5 fraudulent Torahs, essentially Dead Sea Scrolls, that turned out to be not so much Dead Sea Scrolls. But they've got money to burn, and you got to appreciate when the grifter gets grifted. That's what the stuff movies are made out of. Folks, and of course, we will get to these stories about these various bombs that are found, disturbing, super disturbing. We will get there in a bit. I should just tell you one of today's sponsors is newsvoice.com/majority. You all know about, in fact, I just wrote a really interesting piece by Matthew Iglesias. Those guys at Vox are writing some good, like, sort of cultural type of pieces these days that I'm enjoying. And this one, he talks about the hack gap, which is, another one of my bailiwicks, which is, the liberal media back in the day when we used to talk of, like, the center-left media was cowering from the right. I'm talking about the aughts, of course. And on the left, there was no version of Rush Limbaugh. I mean, we certainly tried to build something akin to that. But there's no Rupert Murdoch ever. There's never been a left-wing version of Rupert Murdoch. I don't know that you could have one, but there isn't even a functional equivalent. Never mind, the same sort of qualities. But there's a new media company that's come up with their own response to some of these problems. It's called News Voice. It's an app for iOS and Android, which you can access for free if you go to newsvoice.com/majority. And it gives you a personalized news feed by aggregating a mix of mainstream media sources, international sources, and independent media sources. This is actually, like, would be a good thing to turn on if you have a friend who, or a family member, who only listens to Fox News or watches Fox News or reads Fox News. This would be a good sort of, like, sneaky way of getting some daylight into their dark, danky media news sources. Because multiple sources are provided for each news story. The entire app is fueled by crowdsourcing. You can upvote stories you think are important so more people will see them. You can add stories to the app, or you can add a source that's missing for a story. It's meant to be a completely open and democratized news aggregator that lets you get every side of every story. They also have a video interview series featuring guests from Chris Hedges to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Go download the app for free at newsvoice.com/majority. Put a link under this video if you're watching on YouTube, and or if you're listening, you can find it in our podcast description. That is newsvoice.com/majority. All right, let's get to this. This was pretty stunning. Obviously, we are now less than 2 weeks away from the election. The president is lying about a caravan that is, 1,000 miles from the border of the U.S. But they're coming here quickly. They're walking at a fairly brisk pace.
For your lake house.
Yeah, exactly.
To challenge the Constitution.
And of course, they apparently are not only coming to invade the country, but also to pass a middle class tax cut that Congress hasn't even contemplated yet. That is according to the president. But still dealing with the implications of the Saudis being bold enough to kill a U.S. resident and fairly well-known columnist in the Washington Post in their embassy because he was critical of them, which gives you a sense of how sometimes these things happen, where leaders from foreign countries feel like, oh, the U.S. has basically said the gloves are off. We have no handcuffs on us anymore. We can do whatever we want. And then they sort of get it wrong. We have a history of stuff like this going awry when that happens. Check out the 91 invasion of Kuwait by Saddam Hussein as a starter, or the Israelis heading up, I think it was into Lebanon again, and basically also exiting Gaza unilaterally and creating another mess there. Here's Donald Trump being asked about his perspective on the Khashoggi murder at this point, where it has become increasingly clear that he was murdered. And here, well, increasingly clear in terms of, I mean, it's quite clear to everyone who doesn't want, you know, who doesn't have a vested interest in pretending otherwise. But even in the context of those who do, it's becoming, you know, clear that they can't maintain this charade anymore. And here's Donald Trump expressing why.
Mr. President, why do you think something like this could have happened? Do you think that there was a failure of leadership on the world stage, that Saudi Arabia wasn't concerned about?
They had a very bad original concept. It was carried out poorly, and the cover-up was one of the worst in the history of cover-ups. It's very simple. Bad deal, should have never been thought of. Somebody really messed up. And they had the worst cover-up ever. And where it should have stopped is at the deal standpoint, where they thought about it. Because whoever thought of that idea, I think, is in big trouble. And they should be in big trouble.
Did they tell him don't refer to anything that actually happened? Just call it a deal? I don't understand. What are they talking about?
What he's trying to do there, I think, is first, I think he's genuinely offended by how bad the cover-up was. This is a guy who spent a lot of time around Nicky Scarfo and other really reputable members of organized crime. And the Saudis are literally in the process of doing, like, yeah, it's just this weird rogue hit squad that had no connections to any senior leadership and bad ideation. So I think he's still trying to give them cover.
Those grooves are worn so deeply in his brain also that everything is a deal to him.
It sounded like
he's on set.
It sounded like he was on set at The Apprentice and basically talking about, like, some attempt to sell, hot dogs in Times Square. Like, hey, and the other way, it was executed poorly.
The Prince, I mean, the first couple of contests, you were so good. You did a great job on Yemen. You had a great photo on Instagram with The Rock. I don't know what happened with you. It was bad at the ideation standpoint.
You're saying a heated ice cream spoon that you have to keep plugged into the wall. I'm just not buying it.
I'm not seeing it. So, Mohammed bin Salman, you're fired.
It really did sound like that. It's almost like we got to address this, but you can't say anything of actually what happened.
This
is like what the one thing I can do.
Don't worry, I got it. First of all, everybody can agree it was a bad deal.
Bad deal.
Finally,
poorly executed.
Poorly executed.
I'm sorry. No pun intended.
Yeah. This is the type of deal you could have easily set up a fake car accident. I mean, there's a lot of traffic.
Yeah, blame it on Istanbul. Blame it on a woman driver. I mean,
blame
what do you think?
I mean, then that could reinforce the whole point of Saudi policy. I mean, you guys just weren't thinking. Frankly, it was a mess. Mohammed.
So what? I don't understand. What does he think that they're setting up? I mean, whoever came up with the idea is going to be in big trouble, and that's going to be some guy,
yes,
like one of the guys who came in, the 15 guys.
That's
it was
what he's saying.
His rogue idea,
that's
and that was
saying.
A bad deal.
That's what he's saying.
Right, but no one's going to believe that. Like, who is this for now?
Well, who it's for potentially is the king. Has actually been coming back into public. You know, he's very old and he hasn't been on TV much because they give it all to the prince. He's coming back and being like, all right, I'm still in control here. So it's possible that The substantive thing is that this might be it for the prince.
Monarchy's rule.
Is that really?
Yeah, I think. I mean, not. I'm not saying it's likely. I'm not saying I put money on it, but there is a tangible.
I don't understand.
If he undercuts, if they say this isn't the Saudi system, this kid is out of control and he's nuts.
Is it possible he's doing it for his base as well?
No,
because they hate the media and journalists.
I just don't think.
Oh, I mean,
that,
he did do that. Gianforte
I just don't think
thing.
That the yeah. But I don't think that
the base isn't thinking about
the base that. Is like Saudi. I don't
like
think...
has he implied yet that the journalist deserved it and all the other journalists better watch what they say?
No.
All right. Fair.
Although I did. It was interesting. We'll see. The Saudi foreign minister went on Fox for his first interview in the U.S., but that's just because Trump will be watching.
All right. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this.
Let's go get out in the street. Somebody's gotta. Let's get the stars to align. Power lands a slaughter. And look for the grass. Your eyes make a signal pass.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the Arva E. Strickland Distinguished Professor of History and Black Studies at the University of Missouri and the author of Land of the Fee, Hidden Costs and the Decline of the American Middle Class, Devin Fergus. Welcome to the program, Devin.
Pleasure to be with you, Sam. I wish it could be on a bit brighter topic and subject, but it's a pleasure to be with you nonetheless.
Well, what was it that led you to look at? Well, maybe we should define fees first, just so that we get a sense of what we're talking about.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I use this expansive definition of fees. So by fees, I'm talking about any cost or expense which is in addition to principal. The private sector, for instance, plays kind of a shell game in order to sort of circumvent regulators often. And so, for instance, when petty loans sort of first sort of hit the market in the early 1990s, one of the ways in which they tried to circumvent, especially sort of state and some level federal regulators, by saying, no, we don't charge interest rates, so this isn't usury. These are actual fees. These are sort of administrative costs, administrative fees. And so again, the use, my use and application of fee is sort of an expanded one. It's anything that's in addition to principal. So, for instance, an origination fee, as I gave the example with the petty lending industry, it could many times really be a fee as a de facto APR or interest rate, default fees, prepayment penalty fees, as you would find, for instance, in subprime mortgages. And so these fees come in all kinds of shapes and sizes and colors, but it's in effect anything that's in beyond the principal loan amount. And we see fees in the public sector, right? Fee as this sort of proxy for taxes. And we can have that kind of brief conversation if you want to as well.
Well, I mean, I remember that back in the day when Mitt Romney was governor of Massachusetts and he promised no new taxes, and then he just basically instituted a ton of new fees. I mean, the big problem, it seems to me, with fees as opposed to taxes is that fees are far more regressive in terms of a form of revenue for the government, and also far less, I guess, transparent.
You hit the nail on the head. I was gonna wave with the transparency argument, but you already did it precisely. Far less transparent. And often we find with fees that they're often difficult and almost impossible to opt out of. And so the implication of a fee is that a fee is sort of item driven. But we know, let's say, in higher education, so the state of California may not raise its tuition, but they sure as heck raise their fees. I'm a university professor. Students at the University of Missouri have to pay tuition, but there are these in-cost fees. And if they don't pay the fee, the user fee, they cannot sit in my classroom. And so the implication is that fees are sort of an itemized sort of thing, an a la carte sort of thing. But in reality, these fees are often some critical, integral to the cost of a product, and it's impossible to opt out of. In the same way that often taxes are. So absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. So, okay. So you've, I feel like you have already half answered this, but just give us a sense of the size of and the importance of these fees in a broader story for particularly the middle class.
Sure. And so what we find is that, again, the cost of these fees cost over $1 trillion per U.S. for the U.S. And broken down to, let's say, an individual, individual median income, eats up at least almost half of their income. And so we're talking, and I'm talking about particularly fees, and this is important too to point out, Sam. My work really looks at often fees in critical areas of upper mobility. So I'm not necessarily talking about, let's say, a cable user fee or something like that. And that's important and significant, or a cell phone fee. Again, I wrote a piece a few years ago for New York Times about the rise of phone fees. But I'm primarily talking about fees that are essential areas of upper mobility, fees associated in things like housing or higher education, fees that are linked to employment. And we could sort of talk about the ways in which the private sector, the most ubiquitous and common response to issues of wage stagnation. And then what takes us from home to school and work, fees that are associated or attached to transportation. Particularly employers want people with, quote, reliable transportation, i.e. a car. And that's what employers mean by reliable transportation. And then there are fees that are associated with, again, the automobile, particularly or insurance fees. And so what we find is that not since they have fees sort of escalated in all areas, but particularly these four spheres in which have been critical for upward mobility: housing, education, and employment, and what takes us from home to school and work, the automobile. And these fees have created obstacles for barriers for entry into the middle class. And they've also worked to actually erode the middle class in various ways.
Let's talk about this is timely. I think my audience is aware that I had a debate with a guy who, I don't know, you may be familiar with. He spends a lot of time on college campuses from Turning Points USA about sort of the about the middle class and some of these things. Particularly, we got into the housing crisis and the subsequent financial crisis in 2008. Let's talk about housing first in terms of these fees and what the implications are, and how, in many respects, I mean, I am familiar with some aspects of how the fees drove this crisis and that we've talked about on this program, both, I think, in the origination of mortgages, but also even in the wake of the crisis, the allure of fees for a lot of these banks was greater than their desire to refinance or amend existing mortgages under HAMP. But tell us where fees play the most impact in the story of subprime.
Sure, absolutely. And so what we find with, for instance, the rise of the subprime mortgage market is that all of these the subprime mortgage loans or products which had these creative or toxic instruments, prepayment penalties, which is one of my favorite sort of financial instrument, mortgage toxic. Right? It's sort of counterintuitive. It penalizes someone for paying their bills earlier on time. And so, I mean, that would be sort of one example. The balloon payment fees, as well as just for mortgage sort of charges or fees, all of these aspects and products that are associated or attached to a subprime mortgage, all of them increase the likelihood that a borrower would go into default. Each of those aspects that were associated or attached to the subprime mortgage. And you're precisely right. Initially, subprime mortgages get marketed to people who have less than stellar credit scores, i.e. something less than sort of 660, but it becomes so profitable that by the time we get to the financial crisis, the average prime borrower was being sort of shunted into or channeled into the subprime mortgage market just because of the profitability of these subprime mortgages. And so, again, they become extremely sort of profitable. And here I'm going to sort of say this to you, Sam. I'm also a visiting professor in Northern England at the University of Northumbria University in Newcastle. And then in the UK, it's conservatives who are pushing for creative and inventive ways to help consumers have stronger credit scores. Specifically, it's conservatives who are arguing that, let's say, your rent be included as far as your credit score, right? It would be wonderful in the U.S. if you would find conservatives who would make an argument that let's not try to channel people into these subprime mortgage markets like we're having people now do today by saying the underwriting standards in part are, at least under the Obama administration, were too tight. We need to loosen those standards. It would be great if we could have conservatives in the U.S. who would actually make the argument. Let's redefine what's a quality credit history and not simply look at the history of mortgage borrowing, mortgage lending, but look at people who pay their utility bills on time, pay their rent on time. Those kind of ways could, if you use that, it would actually help borrowers increase their credit score, which would mean that fewer borrowers would actually be shunted into these subprime, or now it's called non-prime markets. Is it a thorn by a different name is still a thorn.
Right.
Now it's called non-prime mortgage products. And so it would be wonderful if conservatives in the U.S. would take a page out of conservatives, at least in the U.K.
And people should understand that the subprime is just simply a way of justifying far more fees, right? So there is because the idea is that not only do we jack up an interest rate because we're theoretically taking more risk, but also what is the justification for the fees in this instance? We're taking more risk, but we want to take more risk so that if you pay this thing off, there's a prepayment penalty, or is it also that there's an awareness of like, there's just probably a correlation between people who have poor credit scores and people who are not financially savvy?
That correlation is absolutely there as well. People who have lower credit scores aren't financially educated. There's so much to discuss here, Sam, because we can argue that it's not necessarily financial education is the key. And in fact, we've gone through a period now, the last 30 years, in which financial contracts and documents have gotten exponentially longer, right? And at the same time that the individual and the time they have to process all this information, that time has gotten increasingly lessened. And what I mean by that is individuals now today commute much farther than their grandparents or parents did 30 or 40 years ago to go to work. You're also working longer hours than people did a generation or two ago. So you're working longer hours, you're commuting farther. You're also in this sort of what I like to call this sort of extracurricular arms sort of race. I'm a parent of a child. My child just came from French class. He has a martial arts class. He's in all these extracurricular activities. Why? Because he's competing against other kids of the same sort of class in college, right? And so we experience now as individuals have less time than ever before to read and process these complex financial documents, which have actually gotten much longer over the last generation. And so how do you square this circle? And the way you square the circle is by bringing in financial regulators having them delegate responsibility. And now the private sector understands that there's a process of information asymmetry, that you have less time to process this information, and that financial literacy is really a canard or a red herring because of for sundry reasons. Some I sort of laid out, others we can sort of get into. And so they take advantage of borrowers across, I'd say, the income spectrum, but is most devastating on historically vulnerable populations.
And the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau went a long way in requiring more plain English and shorter forms, particularly, I don't know, as much for mortgages, although there were certainly reforms in that process. But across the board on some of these contracts, particularly, I think it was, you know, like credit card contracts and whatnot.
Absolutely right. And we see what's happened there with the current acting Director Mulvaney, at least, going through a process of actually of catch and kill negative reports by his staff who come out with negative reports about the industry. And so and this is one of the great ironies, right? For a long time, conservatives have made the argument, we don't need regulation. We just need greater, fuller disclosure and financial information and let the consumer decide. And what we've experienced now in the last few months is actually these sort of same pocket or slice of conservatives providing less information through this via these catch and kill of reports that CFPB have been trying to put out. But again, Mulvaney and others, as well as Betsy DeVos, who's an education department, have been catching and killing and suppressing. And so, yeah.
Let's talk about student debt. You bring up Betsy DeVos. One of the things I know the Trump administration has done in terms of deregulation was we have this massive problem in this country that it was actually quietly, I think one of the things that the Obama administration was doing quite well was beginning to crack down on what is not 100% a scam. Nothing ever is. But the for-profit university industry is largely an extraction machine trying to extract public money via student loans to students, and they tend to be a little bit older students who are going to these universities ostensibly to increase their earning potential in the business world. There's very little data to support this, and there was a regulation that if you were an institution that was putting out was handing out diplomas to people and they would go back into the workforce and there was no return on investment, you had certain limitations as to how much revenue you could derive from student loans. And Betsy DeVos basically said, "Oh, we're lifting that. You can keep pumping out people with a product that is defective, and we'll still keep giving you money." Talk to us about how the student debt bubble grew and what the implications are, and particularly in the context of fees.
No, you're absolutely right. And the origins of the growth of the student debt bubble really dates back to to the Reagan administration. And here I'm going to sort of take a bigger, broader step back and have a look at a sort of almost a sort of meta view. And it was just a fundamental philosophical shift that occurs by Reagan and the Reagan. And so the architecture of the financial aid program really sort of gets in place in the 1950s under Dwight Eisenhower. Now, a Republican. Now, Eisenhower wasn't some flaming liberal, but actually in many ways was sort of reticent about even the financial aid program. But he sees the value of financial aid for college students, particularly as a means to address national security issues. And so Eisenhower and others sort of erect the financial aid system. And so since the 1950s, the financial aid program, a system, had been a bipartisan sort of project of both liberals and conservatives. And those who are students of U.S. history know about the consensus era of American history. And this is sort of a reflection of that. So, but in the 1980s, what you find is a fundamental and a dramatic shift by conservatives who begin to see the expansion of financial aid in its existence to students, and begin to see students not as future tax contributors, as Eisenhower and others saw, Eisenhower and obviously Lyndon Johnson, but in the 1980s begin to see students as tax eaters, not as future tax contributors, but as present day tax eaters. And imagine and looked at and use the rhetoric of using students as similar to those who are on welfare, so the welfare queen or the unemployed father who's bilking money out of the system, or grandma on Medicaid, and then basically sort of lump the college student in with quote unquote these undeserving poor. And with that sort of mindset, what they did was they rolled back low interest student loans, they rolled back grant programs, and invited the private sector more so into the funding and finance of higher education. And that invitation to the private sector gets enlarged in the 1990s under Clinton, but primarily it's actually radical Republicans who do it. And then remember the Congressional Republican Revolution of 1994. And they basically push back against something called direct lending in the 1990s. And they really muzzle Clinton and those who are pushing for direct lending, and they expand the private sector market and push back against sort of government regulators in education. And what we find with this rollback of direct lending in the 1990s is that
elaborate if you could on direct lending. Just explain to us what that program is.
Sure. And I'm going to sort of say that direct lending is almost as it sounds. And so rather than a system in which direct lending is basically where the government lends money primarily from the Treasury directly to college students, or gives it to the financial aid office in the college, and then they disperse it to college students. And that system really cuts out the middleman. It cuts out, for instance, the subsidy banks, which might be subsidizing the loan. It often cuts out the loan servicer. And so it was more of a direct lending from government to the student. And again, that system, which cuts out all these middlemen, whether it's the banks on the front end or really student loan services, reduce the cost of the student loan. I mean, if you can imagine, just the administrative costs are cheaper, right? And not simply the administrative costs are cheaper, but also the actual loan product itself is cheaper. Now, let's imagine this, Sam. Because the loan itself is cheaper, it means that the student who has to pay back that loan has to pay back less. And what we know in whether it's mortgage market or whether it's payday lending or whether it's or higher education, if a particular financial product is cheaper, as logic dictates, it means that the borrower is far more likely to pay it back. And so that means that the borrower is far less likely to go in default, which means that the taxpayer who's actually funding both the direct lending as well as subsidized lending programs is far more likely to get their money back. So a government gets the money back, students get their money, and they get it faster. And so it was a system which actually worked for every population except for the financial services industry. And so because it didn't work for them, they push back and they pressure lawmakers to bring them back into to the system. And this is what happens in the 1990s. And they push out direct lending and they bring back the private sector. And then you see a whole slew of abusive practices and quid pro quos. And once government gets pushed down in terms of direct lending program, private sector comes in and then they begin to give sweetheart deals to financial aid officers, kickbacks of various sorts. We just had a World Series game last night. Unfortunately, my beloved Dodgers lost. But let's say in the 1990s, you wanted to go see your Yankees play in the World Series. The bank might have a couple of tickets for the financial officer, and they'll give that financial officer some tickets if they would give them access to student lenders. Now, once the bank got access to the student lender, I'm sorry, to student borrower, I should say, they didn't care, the university or the education financial office didn't necessarily care the kind of terms that were given.
Right.
They were just caring about the kickbacks that they would get. And this is a system that existed from the 1990s through the 2000s. And we see several state attorneys general with lawsuits against various student lenders through this system. That was the abusive system. And the great shame is that DeVos and the Trump administration want to go back to this sort of wild, wild west sort of attitude of the 1990s and 2000s, where there's all this abuse taking place. We see the origins and rise and spread of student loan abuses and student loan debt.
So, all right. So, just to make it clear, and also to take the opportunity to state that I'm a Red Sox fan, and so I'm very happy about last night. But
you'll be happy about tonight too. I'm sure.
I'm hoping so. But so we had this type of abuse where there was a sort of like extraneous middlemen that were placed into the process of delivering government backed and government really funded loans. We threw that off. We still obviously have a huge debt problem, but now we're starting to see first the sort of the first order problem we have is fees that are generated and extraneous from private debt collection agencies that are now making their return back, you know, following the Obama administration, where there was a significant push that, to the extent that it could be done just through executive order, to push a lot of these people out from the loan process. We still have a massive problem with loans, obviously, and a problem with the rising costs of education. But this is sort of like an added on attribute and. So where, what is that? Do I have that history right? That they were pushed out of the industry to a certain extent, and they're being brought back in?
No, absolutely right. Push out of industry to a large extent through direct lending, and now they're being brought back in by the DeVos administration. And again, this is, I'll stress this too, it's by ideologues because. If you want to do a simple cost-benefit analysis, these loans are still cheaper and more efficient if done by government. And so if they're really concerned about what's the more efficient sort of product, it would be to kick out keep the middlemen out and to have a direct lending program. And this is actually, again, both bipartisan administrations have done studies and research on this. And so, for instance, Lawrence Lindsay, the Republican under George H.W. Bush, I mean, talked about how efficient a direct lending program was vis-a-vis guaranteed student loans. But again, this is driven by people with a sort of particular agenda and also by this sort of close relationship with the donor class, the financial donor class, and those two things have created and created this problem. I will say this is one sort of coda too, that I view as not simply an add-on to the story of the rise in cost of college. It's part of the bigger and broader story, because what happens too is that the federal government begins to roll back its contributions to higher education.
Right.
And so that means there's a shift in that cost from the public sector From public sector to individuals, from institutions to individuals. And this is what explains in part the rise of cost of college. And so it's part of this bigger story about the public sector and government's rollback of its contribution and support for higher education.
All right, and lastly, I mean, you also have a chapter on wage stagnation and the implications. It's almost there's always like sort of a push and a pull, right? Like this dynamic where the federal government rolls back funding for publicly subsidized colleges, states cut back on this. Therefore, loans come in to fill that delta because students now are required; they have more responsibility to pay those fees, and then that gives the opportunity. I mean, the fees to actually go to college tuition, and then the private industry comes in as like barnacles on this transaction as a way of like stripping more cash out of that system. And on some level, that's what we see too with the idea of like payday lending, is that on one hand you pressure, there are forces that create wage stagnation. And then the other hand, you come in with a sort of a neoliberal solution, as some would characterize it, which is like, oh, we're going to loan you money so that you don't actually need to get paid. But we're also going to make a lot of money off that transaction. It's going to throw you deeper into debt. And so you'll be a repeat customer until one day when you can't.
You've summarized it very well. So there's very, very little I can really add to that. You're absolutely right. That the rise of payday lending is really the private sector's most common, ubiquitous response to the generational crisis of wage stagnation. And I say most common response because there are more payday lenders out there than McDonald's and Starbucks, and studies show McDonald's and Starbucks combined. And so they're common. They're almost everywhere. And payday loans, unlike a credit card, payday loans is expressly designed to address the issue of lack of money from income. And so that's why it's called a payday loan. It's the loan. For that loan, you have to have two things, which we consider sort of really pillars for middle class. You must have a paycheck, a working job. And secondly, you must have a bank account. You write a check drawn from your bank and say that this check is going to be good in 2 weeks from now when I get my paycheck. And so these are the markers of middle class status. But we see that these things, petty lending, again, has spread more wide and, again, more commonplace than both Starbucks and McDonald's. And these things we consider markers of middle class life. And I'll say this too, that the Federal Reserve earlier this year came out with a report that 4 out of 10 Americans cannot cover a $400 emergency expense. And so while we think of payday loans as something that other people might take out, realize that nearly half of Americans now are really living from paycheck to paycheck and lack $400 to cover an emergency expense. So many of us are just one job loss and income shock away from a payday loan. And so it's something that really does open itself up to more consumers than those who are actually taking out the loan itself.
Devin Fergus, the book is Land of the Fee, and it is about the hidden costs and the decline of the American middle class. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam, and go Dodgers.
We'll see. All right, we'll see. Right. I wouldn't bet on it. But I appreciate the time. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye. Take care. Bye.
Dodgers are going to lose tonight, folks. We could be looking at a sweep. This is, you know, one of the this dynamic with these hidden costs that are just another thing, you know, in the course of the debate that I had with Charlie Kirk was just another. And this is, of course, a long, not exclusive to the Trump administration. and not simply a function of the Republican Party, but largely they are, you know, largely a malignant force in our politics, and a malignant force when it comes to draining, extracting wealth, creating the problem, then extracting wealth from the solution, rather than just starting with the solution, and which is very often just our government. There's no reason why we need to be loaning money to students to go to school. We could just finance the school and give everybody the option to go for free.
That's what Charlie Kirk objects to when he says, "Don't say free stuff, Sam." What he's really mad about is that nobody's going to be able to take a cut on the interest.
Well, it's two things. It's that, but it's also he made it very explicitly clear. Like, you're going to take money from me to pay for somebody else's college? And now we take money from people all the time to pay for other people's expenses. We take money from non-homeowners who pay taxes so that homeowners can have a mortgage deduction, finance the purchase of their homes. Now, but doesn't necessarily make it available to everybody because you have to have a certain amount of cash to start with. So it basically subsidizes wealthy people's ability to extend the buying power of their money. But you need to first get into a certain club where the dues are, you know, X number of hundreds of, you know, tens of or hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of down payment. And then you can get there. We do this with all sorts of things. We subsidize roads. And if you take public transportation, you subsidize roads so that people can have commerce and make all their money. Charlie Kirk in our debate talked about somebody goes out and buys a building. I don't know. He had a very sort of like narrow perspective on what capitalists do. They all go out and buy a building and then they start a factory. And, but you know, that building has running water. And I can assure you the person who bought that building did not pay for the pipe to go all the way to the reservoir and to go to the sanitation and to go to the treatment center and the electrical grid and the transportation that's involved in there. And then the fire department, right? And the cops. I mean, they're going to protect that building. I mean, so it goes on and on. Charlie Kirk really, really had a problem with his tax dollars subsidizing, you know, something that he either gets from his folks or from, you know, some right-wing billionaires in the context of his job. He could get it either way. But he built that. He built that from he already had a lot of scaffolding. Let's put it that way, folks. All right. And speaking of which, in the fun half, we're gonna go over the. We're gonna go after. We'll take a look. It's hard to know, but in the fun half, we're gonna go over the 20 minutes of the debate that, for whatever reason, were excluded from the TYT video that we played yesterday, and it was sort of the most fun 20 minutes of the debate, in my estimation. We're also more information of the various pipe bombs that have been sent. We are now at CNN, Eric Holder, Obama, Clinton. Am I missing one? Eric Holder was just the most recent.
Was it Kamala Harris one too? No?
So there's some sketchy details on that.
Okay,
one.
So forget
Debbie
that
Wasserman
one.
Schultz apparently got one. Maybe there's more.
I'm maturing as a person.
There you go.
You said Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and I went right to the Jimmy Dore voice. It was almost like an involuntary physical reaction, and I didn't actually do it.
John Brennan was apparently named on the CNN one. That's unclear. Oh, I see. Let's see. So suspicious packages also sent to Eric Holder, but to the wrong address. As with packages sent to George Soros, Clinton, Obama's, and John Brennan, care of CNN, the return address was Representative Wasserman Schultz. Very poor job of doing a false flag, because she should not have put her address on there.
Well, and also just think of the courage of George Soros to have a bomb planted in his own mailbox.
Yeah.
I mean, that takes
commitment. Apparently Wasserman Schultz, I think, also got a maybe something sent to them in a office in one of her campaign offices. All right. We'll continue to follow this story and others as we go. Fox had one of those really unfortunate moments, and we will regarding this, and we will cover that too in the fun half. Folks, just a reminder, this program relies on its members for its support. Every day we try and bring you an interview that will teach you something that you didn't know about either political philosophy or the way our government works or the economic system that we live in, or what's going on with the campaigns. And it is your support as a member that makes it possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. As a way of saying thank you, we give you extra content every day. So jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Our longest term advertiser on this program. Probably only been a handful of shows where I've never mentioned their name at the end since day. Wow, maybe one. I can't remember. Last night was Tuesday night. Michael, you had a program, is my understanding. What happened?
Indeed. We talked about the Madragon Collective, which is one of the largest, maybe the largest cooperative business zone in the world in the Basque region of Spain. And it employs a lot of people, and it shows that worker cooperatives not only might be helpful in transitioning economies on a macro scale, but they actually compete pretty well inside the marketplace as it is today as well, while employing more people. Then Brian Mayer, co-editor of Brazil Wire, we talked about the WhatsApp bulk buying scandal and fake news in Brazil. The political...
Wow. That's kind of... I don't know. That kind of... That's amazing.
Yeah, no, that... I want to get a Lava Jato t-shirt.
I want to get a Lava Jato t-shirt. We also did a little bit of cross-border solidarity and dunked on Jimmy Dore, because Jimmy Dore credulously embraced the car wash Lava Jato investigation.
The vigilant U.S. Imperial PSYOP.
Which literally was an
sentinel.
Arm of the U.S. Justice Department. And part of the breakdown is that while Lula governed in a way that wasn't hurtful to Brazilian business, he'd certainly pissed off Chevron and Exxon by not letting them drill on Brazilian offshore oils or privatizing Petrobras. And we did that, and we did. We also had a very, very fun postgame.
So wait, so let me just, if I can understand it correctly, if he had actually read into the story he was covering and yes. found out that it was bunk, it would have somehow made Hillary Clinton not look bad. And
it actually would have made Hillary Clinton look bad. That's the thing. He literally had an opportunity to even make Hillary Clinton and the Obama administration look bad. He just...
It's a fucking layup.
He just... It was a fucking layup. But because he's... It's apolitical corruption rhetoric and no one bothers to do any research, they actually ended up doing a video that sort of backed right-wing coup forces in Brazil. And...
Oops.
Yeah, oops. And then when we initially commented on it, the response of most of his fans were one of two things, which was either you're being mean or this video's from 2017 and no one could have known, even though it was a year after Dilma was removed from office. But yeah, what are you going to do? We're assholes for sure.
God's working on all of us.
Yeah, God's working on all of us.
Super mean.
Yeah.
Super mean.
Super mean. And
Jamie, please tell me that the Antifada was not mean this week.
We're never mean, Sam.
There you go.
We act...
Learn a lesson, Michael.
Purely on only the purest hate, which springs from the purest love.
That's very pretty.
Yeah.
So what sprang forth this week?
So this week on the Antifada, it's coming out tomorrow or Thursday. We talked to our two friends. That's right, folks. Not one, but two guests this week. Andy Battle, a doctoral student in history at the City University of New York, and Shyam Khanna, editor-in-chief of Commune magazine. First, we talked to Shyam about the awesome media project that they are doing with Commune. And then we talked to Andy Battle, who wrote a great piece on the history of the New York City subway and why it sucks so much. We talked about the tension between urban space to serve human needs and urban space designed to extract profit. From there, we branched out a bit to the decommodification of movement in general, including at the borders of nations. We had a bit of a call to action, some ideas for direct action in that space, as well as what kind of direct action not to do, a.k.a. the kind where you take your pants off.
Matt, did you keep your pants on for Literary Hangar?
I did, no. But I was also mean to a Stephen Crowder, who for Prager University made a video saying that there was never a genocide in the United States because, A, if you look at any of the battles, they're just battles, and B, there was never any written policy, so there you go. And I found that I looked at the very first battle in New England, and it turned out to look an awful lot like a genocide. And I also found out that Winthrop, the governor of Massachusetts Bay Colony, had a bit of a reputation for his treaties and the copies of those treaties mysteriously disappearing before he died. So, interesting.
You know, now that we're talking about Stephen Crowder, and I guess, let me just give you a sense before we go into the fun half. A couple months ago, I don't know when it was, 4 or 5 months ago, 3 or 4 months ago, I was invited to Politicon. And I am, you know, I am of, I'm a little ambivalent about that conference because it, in many ways, just makes politics about entertainment. And, I mean, we do a show like that, but we try and maintain some integrity. That we try and be entertaining, but we also try and deliver stuff that is meaningful. And to center a conference around political celebrities rather than, let's say, you know, policy people or activists seems to me to be a little bit dubious. But the other part of that is I'm also aware of the space in which we operate and the reality of in where we operate. And many people watch this show on YouTube. And frankly, the right is influencing a lot of young people on this medium. And so my sense was, all right, well, maybe I can, if I go, I can get into a debate with somebody and show some young people who are watching videos. I know a lot of young people do that. And this is where they get their political education. And I did not want certain voices out there to have that whole space to themselves and present a perspective that is, I think, wrong and dangerous and unhealthy for the country and have no one challenge it. And so when they asked me if I would come, I said, yeah, I will if I can debate someone. And I was trying to think about who I would want to debate. And the first thing that I first requirement was like, I want them to have a YouTube following because that means that their status is, you know, very largely supported by audiences. And I want to reach their audience. Now, of course, I threw out Dave Rubin and I was told that he's not coming. And
which was a smart move.
Competition would start kicking in.
Right. Competition would start kicking in. And there was other, I think at one point they said, what about Milo Yiannopoulos? It was one of the first people they wanted to hook me up. And I was like, no, why would I debate this guy? No one cares about him anymore. No one watches him.
Yeah, I'll debate him for Politicon 2016.
Well, 2015. Yeah, exactly. I mean, the point being that my agenda was to
separate someone from their audience in some measure. Not the entire audience, just a, you know, a portion of it that might be gettable. And so we went over a couple of people, and we finally realized, like, oh, Steven Crowder. He does that thing where he goes to colleges and tries and makes college students look bad because they don't know supposedly what he knows in terms of politics. And so I said Crowder, and the people are like, great. Steven's interested in a debate. And it all looked good. And then at one point, like, they're writing me back and they're not mentioning Crowder anymore. And I was like, hey, what's going on with the debate with Crowder? What day is that going to be? And they said, can we have a phone call with you? Now here's the thing. In this space, when there's a phone call, they, you know, people don't want emails released, right? And I was told on this phone call that Steven Crowder ghosted. Literally stopped responding to their emails and decided, and I think the quote was, pretty sure the quote was, somebody got cold feet.
That's
I guess
Cuck Crowder is.
I guess someone finally changed his mind after all.
Now, there was also, and I was like, well, and she said something, the person I spoke to said something to the effect of like his team or something, his crew, and apparently his dad is his manager or something. Oh, thank you. And so now I think it was smart of Steven Crowder to avoid debating me at Politicon.
Yeah, he can't just go up there and put on a tutu and say Stalin. It's not going to work. So it was a wise
move. He has a sign out here. All right, take that out. Nice try. But he has, as you can see, he's sitting out there. He has a sign that says, change my mind. I would like to invite Steven Crowder to come on this program, and I will attempt to change his mind. Or I will go on his program and attempt to change his mind. Or I will meet him anywhere at nearly any time at my expense to have the opportunity to change his mind with the one stipulation that we record it on video with sound. So, Steven Crowder, if you are 1/16th, the man that you propose to be, you purport to be, I am issuing you a very specific challenge to debate you. If I have it wrong that you did not chicken out from debating me at Politicon, like chicken out so much that you decided not to even attend, then we can obviously very easily come together and debate on any topic. So I will host you on any time, on any platform, in any way to debate. And I guess we'll hear. Look, because Steven, I know you are watching or hearing this. And everybody else knows it too. There's no way you're not aware that I've issued this challenge now. You knew it was coming when you backed out of Politicon because you were afraid of debating me. And here it is. So you know where to find us, majorityreporters@gmail.com. If you want to get us an email, or you can tweet at me, and I will, of course, follow this up with a tweet to you. And I imagine, you know, I don't know if you'll block me or mute me, but I'm sure somebody's going to get you the message. So, Stephen, we'll see you soon.
and maybe I'm speaking out of turn here, but you can wear your not gay T-shirt and you can have an opening statement. Right? You'll let him have the opening statement, I'm assuming.
Oh, sure. Yes.
Right? And also,
I'm willing to have
you can interrupt any time that Sam is lying or get a fact wrong.
All right, let's take a quick break. Head into the fun half. We'll be right back.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.